academic side, I'm going to have a bit of a luxury, having had the prior speakers elucidate so well what the current legal framework is and what the practical details are of what you need to do. But I want to confront some conceptual problems, I think, in terms of how we're currently handling these issues. And as one of your original session organizers, I now have the luxury to ask, what's wrong with all of what you've heard, why, and how might these be fixed? And the point of disclosure is I have a number of background credentials. I've served on an IRB and bioethics committee for a long period of time. I don't think any of these relate to conflicts of interest in what I'm doing, but I'm certainly going to be taking an academic standpoint and to point out that although I am a member and an active part of leadership of multiple epidemiologic organizations, all of the opinions here today are my own and do not reflect the opinions of those organizations. So I have free rein to say what I think. I'm going to concentrate on four critical problems. First, I think that much of the current federal funding, especially coming from the CDC, now prohibit any and all research. They're oriented towards giving out money for public health practice. They allow you to do various things, any qual evaluation, but prohibit research. And that has led to confusion sometimes as to what may or may not be done. And even more so, when some of those projects get awarded, say, to a state entity, and the state entity works with academia, what is academia allowed to do? And there's also confusion by those state entities related to some of the points that have been carefully clarified already as to what they should and should not do. I don't think the distinction is as clear as has been tried to be made as to what is public health practice versus research. You have a survey that's given out and designed. What are its primary purposes? Who are you giving it to? What are you going to use it for? Giving out that same exact survey by the state government or having it by a subcontract to the state government would call into play different regulations at the moment. And in addition, raises the question as the second party, if they're using that questionnaire and institution, they may regulate that as research. Indeed, my own institution does exactly that. They essentially ignore the public health practice exemption. Everything that is done is required to go to the IRB. They decide that the IRB is the sole body that can make a decision as to what rules apply and whether it's public health practice or research and whether it can go into an exempt or non-exempt category and so on. Second issue that I'm going to cover is that I think research should always be considered as a primary possible goal, especially that we need to get the most bang for our dollars. Resources are always limited, and particularly they are in public health. I think the conceptualization that we aren't doing research is fallacious. I think we should always be doing research in terms of how things were defined. The problem is that research tends to be tremendously overregulated and can be a barrier for much of what we need to do. And in one of the scenarios that Lisa discussed before, there would be an alternative way of how those things might be characterized. And I think that might be a very workable framework to go towards. The third, I want to discuss the failure of our current review system to provide public health protections or even oversight in some instances where it's critically important, and give you some practical examples. And lastly, I think there's a need for input on review groups to have public health practitioners and related experts and epidemiologists on that to highlight that type of issue going forward. The NIH is a research institute. They're putting forward now their blueprint or future blueprint for where research agendas will be. It was discovered when each of the societies of epidemiology reviewed the list of people on that there was not a single epidemiologist. In fact, there was not a single person with public health expertise. We then had the societies go evaluate those issues individually. We came up with a letter to Dr. Zerhoni, the director of NIH. Each of the societies separately evaluated, signed it, and we jointly sent the letter to Dr. Zerhoni complaining about the absence of epidemiologists in any of the ongoing NIH practices. And Dr. Zerhoni's reply basically blew us off and said, not important. It's really not part of their current approach and where longer if you're going at NIH. I think that's a big problem because, as some of the problems you'll see in a moment, we need that type of expertise. So first, we have much of the federal funding prohibiting research. Why? I think it went from really two issues in that direction and why more and more funding is going in that way. When you have the grant or cooperative agreement or contract review processes within the funding agency, they need to be looked at. And when it's public health practice and evaluation, it goes under one set of guidelines. If it's considered research, it's a different one. At CDC a number of years ago, they decided they wanted to be a little bit more NIH-like and wanted to have more rigorous review. That had the catch-22 result of funneling more and more things and saying it's not research, so we don't have to have that type of review. So the exact counter result, I think, of what was originally hoped for and intended. And secondly, I think that people erroneously confuse this whole issue of research in human subjects, and so there is an attempt to avoid IRB review in certain issues. And secondly, sometimes the IRB review is excessive because what we're talking about in public health practice type research are often things where we have much different types of protections we need than we're doing a clinical trial with drugs and some of the and even some of the more invasive types of questionnaires. So I think there are confusions that need to be ironed out. Some of the explicit clarifications with the previous speakers help towards that, but I think we also need to advocate in public health for change. Next issue, that research should always be considered a primary goal. The focus of the common rule is in protection of individual research subjects, and as you've already seen, but I want to remind you, research means a systematic investigation including research, development, testing, and evaluation designed to develop or contribute to generalizable knowledge. I think any opportunity when we do anything in public health where we don't consider as a possibility what its implications can be, what it does for future practice, for other places where we may have similar problems, is a lost opportunity. So I think all of that should be research. I don't think it should be regulated in the way that research is currently. And I think because of this, we've been going further and further trying to separate public health practice from research. I think it's the wrong way to look at that conceptually. I think that research should be highlighted as a laudable goal, that we should strive to encourage it, and that should never be prohibited by funding agencies. Research is now prohibited in a large number of the grants, contracts, cooperative agreements emanating from multiple federal agencies, including NIH, as well as CDC, and we can go on HRSA, and so on. That many public health activities, data are systematically collected and analyzed, so there can be a blurring of distinction between research and non-research. The scientific methodology that can be used can affect how you assess some of that. I don't think that research and non-research activities can be easily defined in methods that they employ, and the previous speakers, in fact, highlighted the fact that that should not be the criteria. But I can tell you that many IRBs, they do employ those types of criteria. And similarly, that many state health agencies are confused on these issues as well. So I'm here focusing on the science, and as we've just discussed, you now have heard a very clear argument on the legal basis for the protections. They do differ for government officials versus others. Some of the activity that is performed, we heard, could be differentiated. It's sometimes practiced by state officials and researched by federal officials. Well, if you now go into academia, you're neither, and it's almost always considered research by your institution. The main focus of U.S. human research protections is on individual human subjects. Neither the Bellman Report nor the Common Rule directly address the benefits or risks to social groups or society as a whole. That's a major, major gap where there is no one having any regulatory involvement. And there are reasons why you might want to see that happen. Perlstadt, former chair of the Science Board at APHA, pointed out that there's the existence of a common good, but we often lack a substantive account of what the common good is. Further, London argued that an individual civil liberties were absolute and inviolable, and it's difficult to reconcile the individual good and the common good. It's a basic seesaw. Given that this framework almost entirely lies upon an individual vulnerable groups, there's really a need to have a parallel framework for assessing research threats to the common good, including socially accepted conventions. It would be valuable to have permit some level of reconciliation between individual interests and societal interests. So if a public health investigation or quality improvement project is deemed part of a legally authorized mandate and is deemed not to represent research, IRB procedures protecting research presented do not come into play at all. This has helped motivate, I think, some of the extensive attempt to differentiate public health practice from research. I don't think we should be going along those lines. Practically, given the laws, we have had to, but it doesn't mean that we should move forward that way. And I think at worst, having this as a boundary is artificial. We pigeonhole and we lose some of the ability to really do investigations that we should. And we also have a tendency to try to have things pigeonholed and move towards minimal risk, and to try to avoid some of the IRV involvement. Primary intent, as you heard, is very much part of how the CDC has operationalized things. That helps us put things very often into the public health practice framework, but I think very often we really should be doing research. And then sometimes people are now reluctant to do the very research that should be done with that limited funding. Skip that. Okay, there are attempts to avoid review by splitting hairs, I think, and it's reminiscent to me of really when you think about sort of revolutionary changes in science, how we had an Earth-centric view of the universe modified by endless patches of things, and it finally collapsed under the weight with great fanfare. I think analogously, the current system is getting overly complex. It's really collapsing as far as I can see. And I think we need to proactively work together to overhaul review systems. So what are some of the fundamental flaws? First, current review only considers sins of omission. Second, there's an assumption of unlimited resources. Three, a tendency to exclusively focus on the protection of the individual. Fourth, no requirement that internally methodologically sound study designs need to be maximally generalizable and risk acceptance about research. I only have time to touch on a couple of highlights of these issues. First, public health outs are not currently mandatory members of IRBs, so the essential perspectives are not routinely included in deliberations. And there's an assumption, however, by the federal review process that appropriate expertise always exists on the local level. It's not true. And unless there's a research proposal, these regulations don't even come to play. The harms that might arise when conducting a system study are now only the sins of commission. What's the problem? There are also harms that arise from failure to conduct research, the sins of omission. This is a major public health issue. There are people who are harmed by, those who are harmed are both the non-participants who are at current risk and those in society who might indirectly have gained from the new knowledge that would have been obtained. So by prohibiting and not allowing something to go forward, we have public health harm that occurs. And that's not considered. And if we look, and you can cross as to whether things are implemented or not implemented by commission or omission, and who's accountable, you see that there are some issues where we have individual investigators, but in terms of issues of omission, it's absolutely unclear. There's no one who's been involved in sort of pushing. So, simple example. Snow accumulates on a sidewalk, penalty. Someone steps and slips and falls. We know that the owner has a responsibility to anticipate this likelihood and to fix the problem in advance. Well, in avoiding public health dangers when conducting research, we know that's important. But omitting something in research to protect against a public health risk currently carries no penalty. Okay, so although you didn't protect people from falling on a sidewalk, if we don't do something similar in a research study, it doesn't matter. Practical example of that. You decide to do huge multi-institutional study funded by NIH looking at one of our major infectious diseases. They decide to look at the issue of discontinuing therapy or not to see how that individual might benefit. It turns out that was an HIV project. If you give highly active antiretroviral therapy, that person's retroviral titers of virus decline dramatically, and they are far less likely to transmit the virus to others. And we know that only a small fraction of HIV-infected people engage in safe sex. So there's a dramatically increased risk to their partners in the community of transmitting the virus for people who stop therapy. In designing those clinical trials, there was no conception about what would happen to others or to society. It turned out it was a flawed study, and they stopped it in the middle because they found out that the people who had stopped taking antiretroviral therapy themselves were harmed. But they did not even look at the larger issues of what were happening in the community, seroprevalence, and issues of having more resistant viral strains in the community. I'm going to be wrapping up now. The assumption of unlimited resources is a problem. The focus on protection of an individual is a major problem. I'm going to go through these slides because these now get recorded, and so those people who want to look through them will be able to see, even though I won't be commenting on the balance of these slides. There's no requirement of internally methodologically sound study designs need to be more generalizable. And if you consider someone who takes lipid-lowering drugs for a moment, presumably they were counseled at the onset to continue dietary restriction just like in clinical trials. And we know in real life that's not what they do. And so they might feel safe to cheat. And so the issue is we need to have sound study designs as designed for actual practice, which encompasses the full spectrum of reduced changes in behaviors. And there can be long-term consequences, as we've seen for things such as Vioxx. There are misconceptions about research. In summary, this is my last slide, in some instances, the current system is overbearing and too restrictive. In other instances, the level of review is inadequate, and public health concerns are rarely incorporated to the degree that most professionals in the field, I think, would believe are clearly warranted for societal interests. That major changes in conceptual frameworks, I think, are required to redress the limitations of the current review systems, and that these are relevant to the development of new structures. And now we're going to have a panel discussion.
So here's the structure for the rest of the session. I'm going to moderate a panel discussion for 10 minutes. We'll leave ample time for what I hope will be a provocative and lively discussion involving all of you as well. And to get our panel started, perhaps I could just frame some questions, although the panel is not obligated to respond to the questions, but I thought this might just trigger a little bit of discussion. I might ask each of them to comment on what they believe the ideal oversight system might look like, what would be needed to create such a system, to implement such a system, and who would need to be involved in restructuring the current system. But they are free also to comment further on what their colleagues on the panel have also said. And with that, to make sure we are all recorded, please speak into the mic.
As I alluded to, I think we need epidemiologists and public health practice officials on review panels. I also think we need them in helping to work out what the appropriate regulations are. I think it is very silly that we give the same type of review right now to fairly innocent questionnaires that we give to very complicated clinical trials. I think it's a different set of experts who should be on the review panel and a different level of review and a different magnitude of material that goes into it. My REB, for example, if there's a spelling error in one word on one document, insists that the new document not be used until the revision has been reviewed by the IRB. It is that excessive. So when you hear me saying that I think everything should be researched and regulated, I respectfully don't think it should be under the current system.
As I said in my remarks, I think that we have two separate systems for oversight and accountability. And my 35 years in public health, I have spent more time on these things than I ever wished or dreamed I would. But my adventure started in 1996 when the state of Alaska applied to CDC for a cooperative agreement to have funding to establish a birth defects registry in Alaska for the first time. The application was approved, the funds were awarded, and as we were trying to get the funds out of CDC, at that time we were then told, and the state had moved forward to go through its process to make birth defects required reportable conditions under state law, which was done with tremendous support throughout the state of Alaska. And then we were informed by CDC that if we didn't get IRB approval, that they wouldn't release the funds to the state of Alaska. So we went to the state of Alaska attorneys, and they said, I'm sorry, you cannot do that. The state legislature, the state administrative systems were adhered to. This is the disease that is now reportable under state law, and you cannot delegate that authority to a group of, you know, 5 or 9 or 13 people that you appoint to rubber stamp that it's okay to do this. And they said, think about it. What if that group said, no, you can't? And so what would happen at that point? Now, in fact, in Alaska and in all the states, there are robust processes to challenge all disease reporting and to hold government accountable for those activities. But we went back to CDC, met with them, had numerous discussions, and they said, I'm sorry, if you don't get an IRB, you can't have the money. And the state of Alaska turned the money back, which delayed the implementation and the development of a birth defects registry. That was my first introduction to civics 101 that I hadn't that hasn't been taught in American high schools for 25 years. And I think what we need to do is all of us invest in robust exploration of the accountability systems by which we hold governmental officials accountable for their actions, and we invest our energies in the systems of the common rule and IRBs. And the fact that IRBs may not be properly focusing their attention doesn't mean that the system of protection is not perfectly adequate. It means we need to do more work in educating IRBs. But these are, to me, the systems are, how do we hold people accountable for the actions that they are performing when they're in either conducting research or they're under state public health powers doing public health practice. Those systems are actually very powerful when they work with each other. I think we have much work to do to make sure that we use those systems properly, and I think that we can do so.
Great. Thank you all. Tough issues that a lot of very smart people have been thinking about for many years, so they're clearly not easy, or we already have a solution. A couple of things that came up that I just wanted to comment on, and in no particular order. One is this whole idea of, you know, the scope creep of an IRB, and I think this is much bigger than this panel and much bigger than any of us really can handle in terms of finding the answer to this, but there is, you know, full literature that talks about how academic institutions and other research institutions who conduct research have begun to, over the last 10 years, really rely on IRBs to be a risk management strategy. It is not the case that something that is not human subjects research would have, I mean, it should have nothing to do with 45 CFR 46, nothing to do with an IRB, should have. It doesn't go down that path. There are other parallel paths for protection of subjects of public health practice. So the fact that IRBs and certain institutions are the ones that determine whether they should look at something, whether they should be involved in it, is just just a very fundamental message that IRBs are doing things that they are not empowered by the legislation to actually do. The question then becomes, what kind of protection arises or results from an IRB that's offering potentially some protection that they're not legally authorized to offer? So that the sense of some false kind of protection or false kind of risk management concerns me in the bigger picture. The other thing that I think is critical for us to think about as we try to find our way through this thorny issue is that there are, in fact, as Dr. Mehta very eloquently described, different authorities for these two different activities. They are different beasts. And not to say that in this environment of limited resources that we shouldn't leverage all the resources we can and get the most generalizable knowledge out of every single thing we do, but when we're in the middle of a Hurricane Katrina, we're not thinking about waiting 4 days for an IRB to approve whether we can make a move. We really do have an obligation as public health professionals to act in a way that our state legislatures have asked us to. So I think that it also doesn't preclude that when we do public health practice that we do have an obligation to be good stewards of government funds and to use those data as best we can. There are plenty of examples where data have been collected for public health practice and later or at a different time there have been research analyses done of those very same data. That is not an impossible situation. OHRP has said over and over again through their guidance that it's certainly feasible to expect that if you have practice data and can answer a research question, it makes good sense to do that. And when you decide that that's the case, you submit the protocol to the IRB just like for secondary data analysis, and there's not a problem doing that. So I think that issue, using the most of our data, I completely agree that we should always be using the data to its fullest potential, but that there, under the current system, it's not impossible to do that. So, but I absolutely agree that we need to think about ways to make this clearer. There are, as I said in my presentation, a number of proposals out there floating about how to make this, how to fix this problem, and I'm actually very interested in your thoughts on what you saw. So look forward to the discussion.
Well, I believe you've heard a wide range of perspectives. I think you've heard that the current system creates some challenges for everyone here, be it simply definitional, be it actually operational. It can be as personal as interfering with the ability to actually conduct the research that we believe ought to be conducted. So before I turn it over to questions and comments from the audience, are there any final words from the panel? If not, then we welcome comments and questions from the audience. Because this is recorded, I don't see a microphone out there. May I ask that you come up and I'll hold the mic for you.
I can hold my own mic.
Okay. And why don't you just introduce yourself as well.
Okay. My name's Alan Trachtenberg. I direct the Research Participant Protection System for the Indian Health Service, which is a federal agency that does have public health authority and responsibility. So that's one exception to the generalization that was made. This has been a very interesting, thought-provoking, and stimulating panel. I have one or two major disagreements, though, with what was generally expressed here. The primary one is I wanted to point out that the common rule, for the most part, says what IRBs and institutions must do. It doesn't really say much about what they may or may not do other than what they must do. So, in fact, it's really up to the institution and if the institution's policies and procedures to determine what it wants the IRB to do or not do or what authority it's going to have within that institution. We're talking about institutions that, for the most part, are self-determining, somewhat different for a government agency, but even in a government agency, there is some authority. For instance, the director of an agency, the director of our agency, for instance, the policy of the IHS has made it very clear, for instance, that our IRBs should and must consider potential harms to the community. So that is very much a part of the authority and agenda. And by the way, we can even justify that under the common rule, because we look at each participant in research as a member of their community, and therefore any harms that may accrue to the community still could accrue to the individual participant. And I think that that's an authority that any IRB could well take and consider. And there is a lot of discussion about that currently in SACARP, for instance. And so that is an issue that's really bubbling up a lot. I did also have a question that comes up for us a lot, just under the current framework. When you talk about generalization, if you are going to take it beyond the participants that you're collecting information from, well, a lot of times a public health authority takes a sample, and so you are collecting information from part of your population, and you're generalizing it to the whole population that you have authority for. So it does go outside, but to me it doesn't seem like that's still research, because you're still within that authority. But I have had members of IRBs saying, no, you're generalizing it to the whole tribe, or, oh, you're generalizing it to, you know, to IHS, so it's research.
Comments?
First, I think the generalizing is exactly what you need to be doing. That's part of standard health practice. That's essential. And people are confused, because I think it is research, but I think it's appropriate research as part of standard public health practice, and that therefore we should not have additional regulations which then look at from calling it research, and that there's legitimate confusion by the IRBs on that issue. And secondly, I think you're exactly right that individual institutions handle things differently. And so at my institution, for that HIV study I told you about, the issue was raised to them about the importance of considering public health implications, and they decided that they did not think it was in their authority to make those considerations part of their deliberations, that they could only focus on the individual. So that they were not forced to go beyond that, and that's a limitation, I think, of the current regulations.
Well, thanks for your comments. And the first thing I talk about is generalization, and that has to do with research providing generalizable knowledge. It has nothing to do with the study mechanism or samples taken or cohort studies or case control studies. If you could just think about any routine investigation of a foodborne outbreak by a health department, there's every expectation of success when the phone rings and you're told that there's 35 people that ate at this banquet and they're now all throwing up and having diarrhea, and then you go out and do an investigation. You may not even attempt to find every single person who ate, as opposed to doing a statistical sample and then to do an analysis of food-specific attack rates to try to identify the implicated item, and on and on and on. And I think that's why one of the areas that has been looked at extensively are things like publication, statistical methodology, those urgency of the problems. Those aren't standards to differentiate an activity as public health practice or human subjects research. And I think that there's very interesting questions about the extent of and practical viability of public health powers and authorities of indigenous people in the United States and in different states regarding their authority to develop public health powers and, for example, disease reporting. And that to some degree has something to do with decisions about which component tribes have Indian country or not, and have those generic abilities to do that. A lot of work's being done with the Alaska Native people, and I know that CDC is working on developing model public health codes to assist tribes in some of these activities, but that's just a whole nother area that we could probably talk about for a long time.
You know, just one quick other comment. I agree with what other folks said, but this idea of you know, generalizability. If you are investigating a foodborne outbreak and you're talking to people who are at the ER about what they ate, clearly nothing you're going to do is going to help them feel better. It's too late for them. But what you're, the practice part of that is that you're actually helping the community from which that participant comes. And so I do think that this has been something that's been talked a lot about, and there has been some guidance from OHRP around this fact that it doesn't have to be a direct benefit to the person you're talking to, but if it's a direct benefit to that person's community, then that doesn't, again, differentiate it as research.
One other short follow-up comment. For some of the things we do, such as outbreak investigation, there's a clear literature, clear methodology. I think that as a general system could be put into effect with a research component approved as a public health practice, and then one need not go back for each separate type of outbreak investigation. You'd be covered under that type of generic approach. I think that that would be a feasible way of getting some of this regulated and to stop splitting hairs of whether it's research or not. When I was at CDC in the enteric disease branch, I saw a tremendous effort in outbreak investigations, and they were always thinking about how they could apply and where there would be research publications going, and many of those CDC branches in those days were very enthusiastic about lots of stuff being published. And now, in their many health departments where research has become a dirty word and publication is a problem, and even I can tell you there have been problems of people coming from the New Jersey State Department of Health to APHA to present because by coming here to a research conference, they think that the work must have been researched and was prohibited by the funding they got from CDC.
Pardon. I'm Jeanette Jackson Thompson. I'm the operations director of the Missouri Cancer Registry, funded by CDC's National Program of Cancer Registries. And since we outsourced the BRFS and the Cancer Registry to the University of Missouri, I am now also a research associate professor in the School of Medicine and the principal investigator on a subcontract with Washington University in St. Louis, which has an NCI-funded R01. And first I want to thank all of you because you are the first panel who has dealt with some of the issues that I have to deal with, and I am so grateful. And second, I want to say to Dr. Weiss, I didn't know that there was any IRB in the nation that was more picky than mine. So you've made my day. I have two questions and a comment. The first question is simple. You said that, Dr. Lee, that submitting data to an IRB therefore makes it not impossible to do research with data collected with federal funding that prohibits research under the current system. And my question on that is, if I am paid to be the director of the Cancer Registry and I have easy access to submit an application for research using that data, but my salary is paid by the through using funds that prohibit research, how can I do it and not be in violation? Then my second question has to do... Okay.
The answer to that question is, according to the IRB, according to the way in which public health practice and research are defined, it is not an issue. Whether it's an issue on the specific contract you have is a different concern, and that's something obviously that, you know, I don't have the contract in front of me and couldn't speak to. But in terms of logistically and from a regulatory perspective, there certainly is the expectation that if data that have been collected for other primary intent or primary reasons could then later be used for research efforts, that is something that is feasible, easy to do. We've done it lots of times, and I mean, obviously encourage that. Now, whether the terms of your contract say you can't do that, that I think is a different issue that I'm not prepared to address.
It's not the contract. It is the Department of Health's interpretation of the contract.
Mm-hmm. Your state.
Your state, yeah. Okay, sure. Understood.
For
execute agreements with universities, either contracts or memorandums of agreement, so that the university is an extension of the health department for conducting surveillance with cancer registries, birth defects registries, occupational injury fatalities, and many other such entities. Those contracts or agreements for that purpose make that cancer registry or birth defects registry a component of the state health department and provide to the people the same types of protection of privacy and confidentiality as if they were state employees. Then if someone outside of that contract wants to do research, there needs to be an explicit mechanism under the Cancer Research Registries Amendment Act for a mechanism for those others than those who are under authority to be able to access the data. And that's when the state may say, you must get your IRB approval as a outside person from that contract. That doesn't exactly address your funding concern, but it has to do with the fact that many universities run and operate registries on behalf of states under their explicit authorities.
In New Jersey, I run into the exact same difficulties you've explained. And I think you now have beside me two authorities to whom we can refer questions. I hope we don't give you a deluge of work, but I think they can help sort out some of our colleagues in health departments as to the appropriate ways of looking at these issues, and I think it's a tremendous help to us.
Did you say delusion of work?
Deluge. Too much work.
The second is a comment that because of the uncertainty that exists and because of the lack of, although supposedly IRBs all are existing for the same purpose and are following the same rules, there are different interpretations. And the idea that you should have public health officials and epidemiologists on IRBs is absolutely correct. My project, which is interviewing women with breast cancer 1 year post-diagnosis, and simultaneously interviewing women without cancer living in the same neighborhoods and matched by age and in some areas by race, was initially not approved, although it had approval from the primary university's IRB, because it was said I had a conflict of interest. I wore two hats. I was both the director of the registry and a researcher. Fortunately, an oncologist said, but I wear two hats every day. I'm a physician, I see patients, I'm a physician, I do research, etc. We overcame that hurdle. Then it was classified as high risk and put in the same pool as people who were getting blood samples taken in clinical drug trials. We almost lost nearly $2 million in funding because of this. Just yesterday, a problem arose where a patient complained. Now we have to get the consent to release confidential information before a patient can sign a HIPAA form and a consent form. And those are so complex that it's difficult for patients to follow all the way through. A person complained that anyone had her confidential information. It was relayed to me that the complaint was a conflict of interest in my two hats. So then it went to the Department of Health before it came to me. When I finally was able to contact the patient, her concern was just that no one should have her information, and she thought it was illegal. So my question is, do you have one simple place where I can demonstrate, quote her and say, and I think one of you referred to this, that research is allowed, and that any research that uses someone whose name was in a database statutorily collected, that person can be contacted. I just want a simple source.
I'm not sure that there is a statement that says someone who is in a registry can be contacted. I don't know that that's, I don't know that that permission is stated anywhere in any of the legislation.
Yeah, I agree that the legislation legislation for you to look at is the Cancer Research Amendment Act of 1993, and that lists the mandatory components that must be in state law. And one of them that required statutory change, at least in Alaska, was the provision of indemnity for healthcare providers that they couldn't be sued if they reported according to the requirements of reporting the cancer cases, nor could they be sued for allowing public health authorities access to the medical records to extract the information needed to populate the registry. There's nothing in there, though, about being able to contact specifically the patients whose information is reported.
I think this is a key example of a day-to-day problem we have in many of our realms of research. And again, I think it's generalizable to a type of policy problem research approach, which could become generically evaluated perhaps and get approval and be used and not cause problems for us at the local level much of the time. But at the moment, your problem is realistic and encountered day by day throughout the country.
You know, you touch upon something about the multiplicity of IRBs, and I think one huge problem that we identified a long time ago, but 10 years later, there still is no forum to publish rulings made by OHRP when cases have been appealed up to them and decisions have been thoughtfully rendered about, you know, what constitutes the appropriate level of oversight in those instances. And so there are many examples that I know about where questions arose within the Indian Health Service, within state health departments about certain activities, and some many of which have involved CDC, that have then been referred specifically to OPRR first and then later to OHRP. But when those decisions have been rendered, there's no forum for their publication. So every IRB that subsequently has that same question doesn't have anywhere to go to figure out that indeed, you know, it went through, in some cases, years of thoughtful processes and responding to either concerns raised at some point in the process. And I think that that's a huge problem and gap, because it only takes one IRB to say no, and that's it. There's no appeal from an IRB decision except for perhaps to drop the project in that particular jurisdiction.
We'll have time for just a couple more comments. Questions? Come on up.
My name is Joanne Bennett. I used to chair the IRB at the New York City Department of Health. I'm not sure exactly where that last discussion was going, but it sounded as though, Dr. Weiss, you were suggesting that there should be some generic framework for advance approval for allowing researchers access to identities of people whose data went into a registry, perhaps for the purpose of aggregating data, and they didn't give consent for their identification to be released to others. And that would be, I think, a bit shocking to me, and also shocking to think that an IRB would go ahead and even approve that kind of a protocol. There's a big difference. There is a distinction between research and public health surveillance and public health data collection. And the example, for example, that you gave about Katrina, before noon on September 11, 2001, we had deployed data collectors to, I can't remember the number, but over 30 emergency rooms throughout the city to collect data on conditions that were both walk-ins and ambulance. Within the next week, the IRB met to review protocols for research projects that were emanating at that time. And, you know, the concept of the need for research review didn't preclude immediate surveillance and data collection. And the other side, back to the initial point about personal identifying information, different states and jurisdictions, never mind registries, even vital records, there's different regulations about how strict you can go in some states and actually get somebody else's birth certificate, as you know, and assume that identity. We probably have among the one of the most restrictive, so that when there's registries trying to follow up from the National Death Index to see if someone has died in New York, even before it gets to the IRB, our vital records department reviews the request to determine whether that research, whether the registry can access it, or whether a subsequent researcher who's using registry data can access that information. And I don't think we can lump a lot of band-aids that have been attached to research review regulations, or, as Dr. Middal pointed out, sometimes a lack of civics 101 and assumptions being made and interpretations being made, sometimes by IRB members, but others, about what the rules mean, and then say, well, we'll get rid of them, or we'll band-aid them again in a totally different intent.
It's after 2:00. The session is officially ended. I'm sure our panelists would be willing to remain up front for any of you who want to remain. I will allow them to continue their remarks, but you're free to go.
Just a comment to your last comment. I mean, clearly what you've just illustrated is the different beasts that are public health practice and research. I can't imagine anyone in this room, well, thinking that, yes, if you are subject to be a participant in a surveillance system because you've self-selected, because you have had some illness, that then your information is suddenly open to researchers. That's clearly something, you know, that no one would think would be an appropriate use of public health data. Whatever impression you got certainly was not on the bandwagon of let's just let that be okay and have a proposal through an IRB that would say that would be fine. I don't think anyone was. But I think it demonstrates clearly this issue of the need for what in public health practice is, very personal and private information in order to do something about an immediate situation. And whether that's appropriate in for a research question or on a research project is a different beast. And so I think that, that's clearly what we're talking about here, is that public health practice is different than research, and we do need a different set of, kind of things to think about in terms of implementing both of those things ethically. There's a piece of, when we talk about omission, I mean, if to not do public health because we can't get identifiable information is unethical. I mean, we have an obligation, an ethical obligation, to protect the public, and so I think it's an excellent point. But I just, for the record, am not advocating that we have some pre-approved approvals that anyone who gets reported to a registry is then open to a researcher. I just wanted to clarify.
And I don't think you fully understood the intent of what I was saying, which first. I think you can create some generic protocols, but they have to be reviewed and must be appropriate. And some of the things you were implying would not be appropriate in such a protocol. Secondly, of course, local places do have separate laws. New York City has its own separate laws, which are very restrictive and must be applied to those situations in terms of what can be released. But let me give you an example of a cancer registry. It's a requirement of cancer registries to do follow-up on what has happened to those people with cancer. And a research issue is, how well are they doing that job? And to what degree do they make follow-up phone calls and efforts? That type of issue, I think, can be thought of ahead in advance as part of the protocols and structure for the cancer registry. So you're both learning how to better do it at the same time as doing the public health practice aspect, which is to collect the essential surveillance data. And you need to decide, what information you can do and under what circumstances and who's allowed to do it. Because you don't want just anyone. You don't want to release personal data for making a phone call to outsiders. You want some people who are appropriately being regulated and followed by the statutory guidelines we've heard.
Okay. just to help with the complexity and make it more complicated, there are different types of registries. And for cancer registries, there are two generic types. One type are cancer registries of mandatory reporting for public health purposes of establishing risk factors and trends over time. There's a second type of cancer registry linked to patient follow-up and recall. And so one, they're not necessarily done with the same authorities, because the cancer registries that are used for clinical case management are done with patient consent. And the component of the reporting under state law without consent is a difference, so that those patients who provide consent in order to have their information in the registry for follow-up and case management have very different oversight than those registries that don't include that and only have data that are collected under state law without consent.
And so with that, I'm going to officially close the session. It's after the hour. I think the panelists may be willing to remain up if you have additional comments or questions. Thank you very much for, I think, what was an excellent session.